From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Newt Gingrich surges on Obama channels Teddy Roosevelt, 14 years for Blagojevich and Europe scrambling. In Osawatomie, Kansas, President Obama echoed TR's square deal.
I believe that this country succeeds when everyone gets a fair shot, when everyone does their fair share, when everyone plays by the same rules.
Newt Gingrich surges on from near last to first.
I'm going to stay positive. I'm going to talk about how we solve the country's problems. And I have one opponent, Barack Obama.
And former money man, Senator and Governor John Corzine swears to Congress he does not know where the disappeared $1.2 billion went from his firm, MF Global.
I simply do not know where the money is or why the accounts have not been reconciled today.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Major Garrett of National Journal, Laura Washington of the Chicago Sun-Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. From Chicago Today, we're joined by Laura Washington, old friend and columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, Tom.
From Washington, the great Major Garrett is here, congressional correspondent and all-powers columnist for National Journal. Major, great to have you.
Tom, always a pleasure to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Laura, and Major.
Major, take us to Capitol Hill first and the sort of boatload, the buffet that Congress has been picking at and kicking around this week. Are they still going to be there on Christmas Eve fighting over payroll tax and unemployment insurance and all the rest?
It's possible, but I don't think probable. What you begin to see and have begun to see, at least behind the scenes, is the contours of a deal on payroll tax, extending that for one more year, the current 2% reduction for employees, not the larger expansion of the payroll tax cut that President Obama originally proposed.
Right.
I think that's largely off the table. An extension of unemployment insurance for one more year, and an issue that's very important politically but not resonant for most Americans, because most Americans are not doctors, but doctors who are Medicare participants are facing a 27% premium cut on January 1st. They are very concerned about that. That will also be dealt with. The question is, how is it paid for? Republicans want to pay for it with a wide range of spending cuts agreed to on a bipartisan basis, though never implemented, but agreed to informally in the conversations between Vice President Joe Biden and Eric Cantor and President Obama and John Boehner, and dealt with at some level of detail by the super committee. What the president would rather do, and he talked about this in Kansas, is impose a surtax on those earning more than $1 million. Republicans have now twice rejected that in the Senate. But their alternatives in the Senate have received even fewer votes than the Democratic president alternative. So everyone is stuck. But it is clear to me that by next week we will have bills that move closer to resolution, and probably on the 20th, 21st of December, a deal that allows everyone to shake hands, leave town, and at least have some approach to the holidays that's not done on Christmas Eve.
These are all big, big deals and big money. The payroll tax exemption going on, the unemployment insurance going on, and the Medicare payments.
About $190 billion.
That's huge. They have stumbled before on how to pay for it. If it's not the millionaire's tax, and you seem to be suggesting it will not in the end be that, where does this come from?
Well, a wide range of spending cuts. Some of it is a continued freeze, for example, to federal employees' pay. Some of it is linked to changes in eligibility for child tax credits, eliminating fraud there, selling off broadband spectrum auction, which the FCC regulates. There's about $15 billion there. Basically, there's about $140 billion in budget cuts or reforms within the federal government that most parties have at least informally agreed to. There's not the $190 billion. I came across, a National Journal obtained a document outlining all the various changes that are going to appear today in the House Republican bill that will be posted on the website, on websites across the country, probably in the next 3 or 4 hours, sometime Friday at least. And there's about a $42 billion gap that is made up for in changes to the president's health care law. Well, you know, and I know, and everyone listening to this program knows, the president's not going to sign off on $42 billion taken out of his health care law. It's just not going to happen. So there's a gap still. and that's going to have to be resolved.
Laura Washington, in Chicago, look at the poker game of politics behind this. I mean, both sides for a while there seemed to be not so unhappy with the way things were shaping up. Then Republicans feeling a little vulnerable there. But the White House word for quite a while was, look, if Republicans want to stick it to millions of Americans, as they frame it, and not because they won't tax millionaires, that is a ball of politics that we can take into 2012 very happily. Does this work for President Obama if what he's got instead is a whole lot of cuts to, you know, child tax credits and federal employee pay and all the rest, Laura?
Right. Well, it can be a win-win for him because he gets all – they still come out of something at the end of the day with this multitude of taxes and cuts and efficiencies that you just mentioned that most people don't even understand. But then he'll still be able to say, but you didn't do anything about the millionaire's tax. And that feeds right into the mantra that he expressed in his speech this week about everybody doing their fair share. That's a very powerful mantra, a very powerful message that he can go into the campaign, into the 2012 campaign with. And I suspect that the fair share mantra, it's all about fairness, may be his new hope and change for 2012.
Fair share, square deal, all the rest. That's the real big thematic umbrella of this week, and it got kicked back and forth. President Obama putting it up in Osawatomie, Kansas, where Teddy Roosevelt was a century ago. The president very deliberately heading to that little town. Of course, he spent time in Kansas as a kid. Here he is in Osawatomie this week saying America is failing its middle class.
For most Americans, the basic bargain that made this country great has eroded. Long before the recession hit, hard work stopped paying off for too many people.
Is it about class warfare? No, he said, it's about the nation's welfare.
This isn't about class warfare. This is about the nation's welfare. It's about making choices that benefit not just the people who've done fantastically well over the last few decades, but that benefits the middle class and those fighting to get into the middle class and the economy as a whole.
All right, Jack Beatty, weigh in here. The president trying to frame up 2012 on grounds that he's never pushed quite so explicitly before. How big a deal is this? How effective is this?
Well, I think the speech is historic. Really, for the first time since it began in the 1970s, a president has identified the crisis engulfing the middle class, quote, as the defining issue of our time. It's about time. You know, for a generation, Mr. Obama's party has evaded the issue of inequality. As a book called The New Politics of Inequality, published as early as 1983, argued, the Democrats elected in the wake of Watergate, many from previously Republican suburban districts, embraced small bore procedural reform over the work and wages formula of the New Deal. The Democrats' willingness to leave economic justice up to the global market, not the Republicans' refusal to raise taxes on the rich, that's what drove the politics of inequality. Now, the president pledges to save the middle class from what he controversially sees as the market's rigged verdict. Can he press that line and at the same time raise $1 billion to demonize the GOP nominee, or will campaign contributions mute his populist trumpet? You know, he's pushed by Occupy Wall Street. He's not only channeling TR in 1911, but Franklin Roosevelt in 1936. Teddy lost in 1912. FDR, welcoming the hatred of, quote, economic royalists, won.
Major Garrett, let's think back. Teddy Roosevelt, 1911. Of course, he did not go on to win, but he got a big chunk of the vote there, and he made a big impression. I mean, when he made his speech in Osawatomie, he was calling in those days for really bold, big changes. Income taxes, estate taxes, child labor laws, corporate regulation, direct election of senators. These were all big, bold initiatives. Matt Miller writes this week about how former Senator Bill Bradley used to talk about the Democrats' pattern of offering big rhetoric followed by what he called the little mouse. You know, no big follow-through. Now, the White House is saying this week that this isn't the moment for the details on this big theme. Matt Miller says it's clear this new world demands bold, creative responses, but that is not what Obama is offering. Is this rhetoric that works? Is this the ramp to big, bold offerings, or just a kind of conceptual framework for campaigning, Major?
Well, it seems to me much more the latter, Jack, a conceptual framework for campaigning. And my experience covering a successful re-election presidential campaigns tells me that re-election campaigns are about a journey. a journey already taken. Here's what I inherited, or here's what I faced when I first arrived as president. Here's what we've done together as a country. Here are my accomplishments, and here is what is left to be done. What I heard, and I think what is can fairly be said about what the president did in Kansas, is he explained a problem. Some on the right might say the president was griping about that problem. The White House would say he identified the problem. He crystallized the problem. Mm. Next must then come the solution, the next part of the journey if he's reelected. How is his administration, how will his policies address or turn that problem into a solution, or at least a partial solution? And if you look at the payroll tax debate, yes, it is a payroll tax debate that forces Republicans in an awkward position of being unenthusiastic publicly about a tax cut, yep, which puts them in a very a vulnerable position politically. But as a matter of economics, what has been the sum total of the payroll tax cut so far? Well, it was the unemployment rate was 9%. Job creation was slack when it started. Unemployment is 8.6 now, but largely because people have exited the job market, and job creation is still slack. As an economic remedy, you have to say the payroll tax cut has been mixed in its results.
At best,
and that still leaves a solution problem for the president.
And hardly bold on the level of what TR was proposing. On the other hand, these are strong ideas. Major Garrett, Laura Washington, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Gingrich on top in GOP polls. Obama channeling Teddy Roosevelt. Europe teeters on. Here's a little bit more of President Obama invoking Teddy Roosevelt in Osawatomie, Kansas.
In the final years of his life, Roosevelt took that same message all across this country, from tiny Osawatomie to the heart of New York City, believing that no matter where he went, no matter who he was talking to, everybody would benefit from a country in which everyone gets a fair chance.
A fair chance. The president with the high-blown ideals there, saying he wants to make it real. This week in New York, Newt Gingrich talked about it in much more earthy terms. Paychecks. Looked to frame himself as a candidate for job creation and paychecks.
But if I do become the nominee, we're going to compete in all 50 states. I don't believe in a red versus blue model. I believe that we are 100% Americans, and I think that if the issue is food stamps versus paychecks, that every state in the country will be in play, and I intend to run as the paycheck candidate, so I'm delighted to be here.
The paycheck candidate. Laura Washington, how do you see the themes shaping up here? There's your paycheck candidate, Newt Gingrich. Of course, Newt Gingrich capable of generating a lot of themes, depending what day of the week. President Obama, though, right, has run through his share as well and trying out this real big emphasis on inequality now. What do you see shaping up here, Laura?
Well, it's we've discussed already. I think what you're seeing so far is a lot of rhetoric. And Barack Obama is the ultimate speech maker. His speeches went a long way to driving his successful run to the presidency the first time around. But one of the things he's been criticized on both the left and the right is being a man of words and not necessarily a proven record. And he's going to have to run on his record. He's going to have to not only put some meat on the bones of those words in terms of what the plan is to get to this fair share, this income equality, this big idea, but he's also going to have to defend a record that has made a lot of folks, even people in his own party and his own base, uncomfortable. I think the Gingrich line about paychecks is sort of goes to the heart of what this campaign is going to be about, which is going to be about the economy and jobs. And there's no getting away from that. And people are going to be expecting at the end of the day in November to see that unemployment rate come down significantly, to see people working again. Extending unemployment benefits is not going to do the job. And so I think it's really going to come down to that. Who can really put some concrete plans on the table that are believable and winnable?
Jack, how do you think this plays out if it's President Obama v. Gingrich, President Obama v. Romney, on the theme that he's now framed his reelection campaign with in Kansas?
Well, the White House seems to want to run against Gingrich, and their campaigning, their ads against Romney would seem to be signaling out Mitt as their target. But they may be have better, you know, what they wish for may turn out not to be what was good for them. I mean, what I'm struck with by is Newt's ability to debate. This week I watched a focus group, but done by Peter Hart with 12 Republican voters in Virginia, and what really came through strongly there was their wide agreement that Newt would quote, annihilate, as one woman put it, President Obama in a debate. Beating Obama was their overriding priority, and they saw him more than Romney as the person who could do that. And you know, if this election comes down to 65,000 voters in Ohio, as 2004 did, and these people are just plugging into the campaign with the debates, the Gingrich skill at marshaling arguments, at verbal dexterity, at shape shifting, and also just seeming creative on the spot, new ideas, new hopes, and so on, that could be a very formidable opponent. Make a very formidable opponent for the president.
Well, look at that. Let's hear from our listeners. Jonathan, Harrisonburg, Virginia, is on the line. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hello. My question for the speakers is just what the what your all's opinion would be about a third-party candidate in this upcoming election having an impact on the election as a whole. There are a lot of voters who clearly aren't behind Mitt Romney yet in the GOP party or any of the other candidates. So since there's no clear leader there, and not everybody is excited about our current president either, do you think there's an opportunity for a third-party candidate to either swing the election or even win the election, which hasn't been done in some time? So I'll go ahead and take your answer off the air, but specifically I'd like to hear what you think about America Elects, the online prospect to try to bring a different candidate in that's not a part of the traditional political process.
Let's see what we've got here, Jonathan. Major Garrett, how about it? I mean, there is clearly, Jack saw it in the focus group there in Virginia, enthusiasm for Newt Gingrich. At the same time, you've got real ambivalence. I mean, the Times House conservative David Brooks today saying, you know, nearly everybody who has ever worked with him knows he would severely damage conservatism and the Republican Party if nominated. And he says a lot more. What about a third-party candidate possibility here, Major?
Let me address the third party, and then I'll get a little bit to Gingrich.
Mm-hmm.
Third party, as a spoiler, absolutely. I think that is a possibility because if it is Mitt Romney or if it is Newt Gingrich, there will be factions within the Republican Party dissatisfied with either for different reasons. President Obama has a noticeable enthusiasm problem that he didn't possess in 2008. He had tremendous enthusiasm. He has less of it now. So a third-party candidate could create a problem. And I would say right now, if I were to identify a person who could immediately change the fundamental outlook of the election as a general election proposition, would be Ron Paul. Now, yep. Ron Paul has historically said he will not run, but in the last week or so, he's become much more judicially flexible about whether or not he will or will not. He won't say that he will, but he doesn't rule it out as emphatically as he once did.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at Ron Paul's support, he could get 4 or 5, maybe 6% in almost every swing state, taking entirely from or largely from Republican votes for whomever the nominee is.
And he's running even stronger than that in many key states right now.
Yes, as a Republican primary candidate.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
as a general election, I'd say you could certainly say 6 to 7%, which would basically make him Ralph Nader on steroids.
Wow.
And a very huge problem for Republicans trying to win the presidency on a narrow margin in a lot of swing states. So the Ron Paul aspect of this is someone who could, if he wanted to, has the organization and the ability to get on ballots, do all the things that you have to do, which are very rigorous, time-consuming and difficult as a third-party candidate. He seems to me, unlike Trump or all these other people, to have the potential and possibly the inclination.
Major, hold that thought right there before we go to Gingrich. Jack, Laura, I've got a little tape here. This was when Newt Gingrich went to New York City to Trump Towers. This was on Monday. Rubbed shoulders there with the Donald Trump in the lobby, went on up for a private meeting. Somebody said they belonged to the same country club. What? I'm not sure where. But they were having their moment in the sun there. Of course, Donald Trump loves that. He was talking there with Gingrich. He's saying, I build a tremendous company. Trump said, I've got a huge net worth. I employ thousands. Here's what he had to say about Ron Paul before Gingrich chimed in.
In all due respect, and this is from me, not from the speaker, Ron Paul has zero chance of getting the nomination. Okay.
The Donald has had the number one show in the country, okay? He is a genuine American icon in his own right. Why wouldn't you want to come and hang out with him?
Who wouldn't want to hang out with Donald Trump? On the other hand, Ron Paul and Mitt Romney, Jack, saying no to that debate that Donald Trump, of all people, is going to moderate. What about that dynamic and the Ron Paul potential for a third-party run here, Jack?
Well, the prospect of Donald Trump moderating the debate got a great quip out of David Korn of Mother Jones this week. He said the thought of Donald Trump moderating a debate is like Newt Gingrich officiating at a marriage. And we're going to hear more of that sort of thing, I'm sure. You know, on this third party business, I see what Major is saying, but what about the danger to Obama? I mean, America elect, that's going for a centrist candidate. I don't know who that would be. Would Michael Bloomberg be tempted? I don't know. But they're getting on the ballot all over the country. There's going to be a space there. Somebody is going to fill it. And if it's a plausible centrist candidate, I should think that candidate could do a great deal of damage to the president.
Laura Washington, you've been showing your kind of Obama's colors lately and saying, you know, looking at how David Axelrod, who likes to play billiards and is good at it politically, might see this. You wrote, just in this last week, it would be so delicious, you wrote, Laura, to watch the Obama campaign bounce him, Gingrich, around the billiard table. Now, are you so sure? What about that enthusiasm that Jack saw in those focus groups among, you know, grassroots Republicans in Virginia saying, come on, we want Gingrich in there.
I think that there is some danger there. I got some feedback to that column with people say, be careful what you ask for. But Gingrich is really a lightning rod. He's both personally and politically, he's been a lightning rod since he was Speaker of the House. He's been a loose cannon as well. You know, he has a lot of good ideas, but a lot of those ideas are kind of a little bit off kilter. For example, his idea that developed this week around having children, learn to work and by doing janitorial work in school. Those are the kinds of things that are going to get him into a lot of trouble. And he's got a personal history that the Obama campaign can make complete mincemeat of it. I think that the asset that Gingrich would bring to Obama is that he would really energize Obama's base, especially from the left, which is the part of the base that Obama has to worry about most. The folks on the left just despise him and everything he stands for. So I think that that would be the asset there. In terms of a third party challenge, I think there could be a third party challenge from the left. Again, that's an area where Obama is weakest, and maybe a Dennis Kucinich, for example, could take that on. But I think that definitely the third party candidacy issue is very, very, very potent right now.
And maybe Ron Paul, his backers are fired up. He's got a lot of young ones. Michael in Waltham, Massachusetts. Excuse me, Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling from Massachusetts, and I enjoy your program always. To get to the point, I would like to differ a little bit from the lady on the panel. Sometime back, she said that President Obama will have to run on his record, and he said that his record is not good and sometimes make the people in his party a little bit uncomfortable. But President Obama has tried to do what he said during his campaign. He talked about health care, and he brought health care. He has tried to do a lot of things, and nobody in Congress is letting him to do anything. So what should he do? I think his record is good, and if he runs on his record and the way he has done what he said he was going to do during his campaign, he's good.
Michael, I'll put that to Laura Washington. Let me get one more here first. Carl in Ithaca, New York.
Thank you.
Carl, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think Obama is the speech in Kansas is sort of the tip of the iceberg. I think he's got 3 years of anger behind that for what the Republicans have done. I think a lot of people in the media are now saying what I have said, other people have said, is that the Republicans basically have been willing to let the misery get worse just to defeat him, and they're so insulated from it. And this whole millionaire's tax is kind of this whole issue of how to pay for this payroll tax benefit, yep, sort of is part of it. And for people that say $1,000 a month doesn't matter, I would say a person who's in that bracket, you know, that means get some clothes for the kids, get some groceries.
You're talking $1,000 a year, but even so, that is clothes.
$100 a month. Let's say it's $1,200.
Yeah, yeah.
Round it up. $100 a month is that is not chicken feed.
Is not chicken feed. No, nor as Major Garrett points out, is it chicken feed in the national budget at large? You know where that comes from. Let me hold those two and get one more. Sharon in Johnston, Iowa. Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, I have two parts to my discussion.
Okay.
Number one, how did they pay for the payroll tax deductions this year? And number two, I'm afraid that we've opened Pandora's box by doing these payroll tax reductions, considering the Republicans against any kind of tax increases. Once they've reduced the tax reduction on the payroll, they'll never agree to get it back to the original payout into Social Security.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because on the other hand, you've got Republicans and others worrying about, you know, I mean, we aren't paying for Social Security in full in this year or two or more when this goes on. Major, first to you, on how did they pay for the payroll tax cut last year and the year before?
One year. It's only been on the books for one year. And it was a debt transfer.
Meaning?
What the administration said was, we will have an IOU from the Treasury Department for the missing revenue for the Social Security payroll tax revenue that would have been there. So you have to raise taxes some point down in the future to finance that debt assignment you've given to the Social Security Administration. This year, there is an attempt. The president wants to pay for it. Mm-hmm. Say, we're not going to do a debt transfer anymore. He's assigned it to the millionaire tax increase. Republicans want to do it by shrinking various federal programs, federal salaries, the other things I summarized.
Right,
so
right.
At least now this year, there's an attempt to pay for it. But the caller is on to something. And I think it's a structural question that this country needs to address. FDR set up Social Security, and he has a very vivid quote on this, with a dedicated revenue stream, payroll taxes. They were not nearly as high then as they are now, because the benefit payout isn't as widespread or as generous as it is now. But we have never before, consciously in this history, and in the history of our country and that program, meddled with the direct financing of Social Security. We are now doing this as a matter of course, or at least we're getting close to that, because if you extend this for 2 years, then it becomes 3 years. Basically, you're talking about a fundamental change of the payroll tax system and the financing of Social Security, where you take general revenue and place it in the Social Security Trust Fund. We've never done that before, and those who have defended Social Security have always said, keep the payroll tax as it is, because we don't want Social Security to compete against all the other obligations of government.
Of course,
what we're moving toward.
Of course, we've never been in a pickle this big since FDR and the Great Depression, Laura Washington. But you hear Michael's call. He says, hey, Ms. Washington in Chicago, don't say the president hasn't done anything. He has on health care, and he wants to stick up for that record.
I didn't say he hadn't done anything, but I said his record is imperfect, and he's going to have to get beyond the rhetoric. There's disappointment about the economy, and he can make the argument that the Republicans have been obstructionists, as one of the other callers mentioned, and have tied his hands. But I think people are impatient. I think people feel that he owns this economy now. He owns this unemployment rate. He owns this the high foreclosure rate. And they want to see what he's going to do about it. The health care agenda, yes, he got health care reform through, but a lot of people don't really understand what that really did for them or what difference it really made in their lives. And there's a lot of dissatisfaction there. And maybe that's fair or unfair, but I think it's very real. That's what I hear. And he was also the big anti-war candidate. And now, yes, he's gotten us out of Iraq, but we're still mired in Afghanistan, and there's a lot of unhappiness about that. Those are three areas that he's really going to have to defend long and hard if he's going to win this election.
Laura Washington with the Chicago Sun-Times, Major Garrett with the National Journal. Jack Beatty, please stand by. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a top-secret U.S. stealth drone down in Iraq. Where its technology goes now, a wide-open question. Here's ABC News' Martha Raddatz.
Whether the drone the Iranians are showing is real or not, or simply pieced together, there is one thing for sure. The Iranians do have the drone somewhere and are no doubt trying to learn whatever they can about it.
Terrible echoes at Virginia Tech this week when a gunman shot and killed a police officer, then died himself. Freshman Juliet Fielding was there when they found the policeman's body.
Police pulled up and they opened his car door. And when they opened it, he just fell out towards the ground. And I could see his face, and it was covered in blood.
And actor Harry Morgan died at 96. He was best known for his role as Colonel Sherman T. Potter on the long-running Korean War comedy MASH. It wasn't always funny.
Every month there's a new procedure we have to learn because somebody's come up with an even better way to mutilate the human body. Tell me this, Captain. How the hell am I supposed to keep up with it? If they can invent better ways to kill each other, why can't they invent a way to end this stupid war?
Let's go to Hank in Mooresville, Vermont. Hank, you are on the air.
Yes, I would just like to talk about the last comments you guys were talking about before the break about how, you know, Obama hasn't done anything and he has, you know, if whatever Republicans want to do, they just want to not give him any inch of ground. Going back to, like, Clear Channel, Heritage Foundation, who have a vested interest into not letting Obama be elected. You know, let's face it, Bush and Cheney, they ruined it. You know, they're 8 years in their regime. They've sent all our jobs over to China. They've given the rich a free ride to make as much money as they wanted. They moved their tax base over to buy offshore accounts tax-free. They don't pay into the system.
You want to put the microscope on Republicans? We hear that, Hank, and maybe give Obama a break? Let's one more here. Buffalo, New York, Michael. Thanks, Hank. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I was calling in regard to the economy itself, and while I think the president has had some successes, we've given the fact that there has been some level of job creation. It could certainly be improved, and I think it might be had the Republicans lined up with their supporters and business and industry to create more jobs. I think that the fact that we've got trillions of dollars sitting on the sidelines from businesses, if those tax rates increased every day, if they didn't make an investment in their business or job creation, I think they would find some way to create more jobs in this economy. As far as some of the comments that have been made earlier, that the president hadn't done much or wasn't doing anything, I'd love to see what those people were saying over the 8 years of George Bush's policy and claiming to be a president, while at the same time, we've got so many more soldiers at home celebrating the holidays with their families. The casualties and the losses are much less than when they were over those 8 years. And I'm really sick and tired of those sometimes Chicagoites claiming that they're supporting free speech. In reality, what they are is shrills for the Republican Party and their lost policy.
Michael, Hank, thanks very much. Hey, Chicago Sun-Times, you shilling for the Republican Party out there, hello, Washington?
That's news to me. The Chicago Sun-Times is a very Democratic newspaper, and it's been a longtime supporter of Barack Obama.
Well, and we see...
That used to be the charge against the Chicago Tribune.
But the Chicago, for the first time in its history, the Chicago Tribune endorsed a Republican presidential candidate, that was Barack Obama.
Forget thee not, Michael, that Laura Washington thinks she can't wait to see the delicious view of the Obama team playing billiards with Newt Gingrich. Well, I don't know if that's going to happen or not. Gingrich getting his own heat this week from inside his own party, friends, allies of Mitt Romney going at him. Here's a little bit of the flavor of that. This is an interview on MSNBC's Daily Rundown. This was Thursday. Former New Hampshire governor, top Romney advisor John Sununu, casting doubt on GOP candidate Newt Gingrich's commitment to his own conservative principles.
I believe Newt Gingrich is a Gingrichite. All he cares about is Newt Gingrich. When you take your friend's principles and turn your back on them, you have a problem. I don't think Newt Gingrich cares about conservative principles. Newt Gingrich cares about Newt Gingrich.
Cares about Newt Gingrich, and he wasn't the only Romney ally coming out this week. Major Garrett, where does the Republican Party go here? I mean, on the one hand, Jack talks about that enthusiasm at the grassroots level, and you can see it, and you can certainly see it in the polls. On the other hand, to go back here for a minute to David Brooks, you know, he's quoting Yuval Levin. This is National Review, conservative publication, talking about the two characters and saying Romney has an executive temperament, organization, discipline, calm, restraint. Gingrich, he writes, has a revolutionary temperament, intensity, energy, disorganization, tendency to see everything as a cataclysmic clash requiring a radical response. And Brooks says he'd make the same point more rudely. He says Gingrich has every negative character trait that conservatives associate with 60s excess. Narcissism, self-righteousness, self-indulgence, intemperance. He says it doesn't matter if a person shares your overall philosophy if that person doesn't have the right temperament and character. David Brooks writes, stay away. How does the party ultimately wrestle with this thing? You know, in the leadership, there is a lot of misgiving about Mr. Gingrich.
Absolutely, and I have great respect for David Brooks, but I would recommend to your audience on nationaljournal.com my piece this week on the history of Newt Gingrich as a manager. Mm-hmm. And I point out two things. One, when he ran for his first elected leadership office back in 1989 to be the second-ranking Republican in the House minority, Vin Weber, Minnesota congressman, said, Newt, I'll be your campaign manager under one condition. If you win, I appoint all of your staff because I need to keep you under wraps. And he put all of his staffers around Gingrich. And when Gingrich became both minority leader and then speaker, there was an enormous attempt by Republicans to build what they called redundant guardrails to try to keep Gingrich on the road. And they described his leadership style as careening madly at a very high velocity around the curves of a mountain road. It was always anxiety-ridden. And that is one of the reasons, and I use this phrase in my piece, there is this feral anxiety among Republicans who worked around with and for Newt Gingrich about what he would be as a candidate and as a president. One other observation in my piece. Gingrich, as speaker, and now, is obsessed with management technology, management structures, management innovation.
Yep.
He talks now about Lean Six Sigma. Back when he was speaker, he talked about total quality management, and he would infuse within his staff all of this insight about managerial structure and how to do things better. He implemented personally not one iota of these theories.
Do you think Republican leadership...
He is theoretical at a very high level.
Yeah.
Operationally, there's this enormous gap.
What happens with that feral anxiety you're talking about? Is there some way that Republican... because Newt hasn't moved out of the 20s in most states and some states gone down. Is there still a smoke-filled room somewhere where Republicans Gingrich down?
No, the only way the dynamic that currently exists now is if Gingrich makes an unforced error. Look, with Romney, better not trot out Sununu against Gingrich. I don't have any stock in this race once whatsoever, but I do know Republican primary and caucus voters. Sununu worked for President George Herbert Walker Bush when he broke his no new taxes pledge and hates Gingrich for opposing Bush on that tactic. Well, most conservatives supported Gingrich on that and loathed President Bush the Elder for breaking his pledge on taxes. Mm-hmm. Sending out John Sununu to berate Newt Gingrich is about the least effective tactic I've seen, and there have been many from the Romney campaign, in addressing an immediate political problem.
Jack, I'll come to you on that first. Calvin in Sumter, South Carolina. Calvin, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How you doing? And Jeff?
Hi.
Okay. I got to go back to the last caller. I feel he was correct. Here's the thing. They keep this going on about, you know, whether Obama has been performing and the things he's done. And we go by what people feel and go by polling and stuff. When I feel we'll do a greater justice by going by the facts, you know, what law has he tried to pass? And who has stopped the law from passing?
Mm-hmm.
Republicans have time after time blocked. Not blocked because they didn't agree with it. They blocked because it's Obama proposing these laws. Because here's the thing. A lot of the laws and the things that he's trying to pass is things that they were a part of. Their ideas. How are you going against your own ideas? And like I said, time, all day long to go by how people feel. Like the lady just now...
Enough with the feelings. Let's get the facts, Calvin. We've got it. Jack Beattie, let me bring that to you in the context of the whole framing the president's working to put out there this week. Block, block, block is what he's seen from the GOP, says Calvin. On the other hand, here's the economy, here's the unemployment rate, and that does sit in the president's lap now. Here's Gingrich with all of his baggage, and nevertheless, you know, Major Garrett says, who's gonna stop the man? What do you see emerging here, Jack?
Well, you know, last month, the Romney campaign workers were told to, quote, keep out of midget boxing matches with rival candidates.
Okay.
And that was code
midget?
For Mitt. Yes, right. Mitt was going to rise above it all. Well, you know, he's very late now to the party. I mean, now, he just, the putting Sununu out is an example of just simply being wrong, which has continued to happen now. People talk about the flawless campaign. Well, really, it was a man sitting on a lead, you know, trying to play, win a game by playing defense. And now it may be too late for him. Newt is peaking just before the Iowa caucus. He's coming up in single digits by one poll here in New Hampshire. He's got this grassroots enthusiasm. The commentariat is frightened of him, but voters see him as a potent candidate. Yesterday is yesterday, and note how wrong the commentariat has been. A couple of weeks ago, everyone was saying, "Oh, his humane stance on immigration is going to really hurt him with base voters." These Republican focus group people in Virginia didn't bother them a bit. They saw it as a sort of deft answer to a complicated human question. So the point is, Newt has thrown out all the old books. He's in the past isn't prologue here, and he could very well take all of this.
Mitt Romney rallying this week at the Republican Jewish Coalition Forum Wednesday. This was in Washington. Mitt Romney throwing out the appeasement word at President Obama, accused him of adopting a foreign policy of appeasement.
Internationally, President Obama has adopted an appeasement strategy. Appeasement betrays a lack of faith in America, in American strength, and in America's future. Like others among the Washington elite, he believes that America's role as the leader of the world is a thing of the past.
Laura Washington, there's an appeasement jab from Mitt Romney. Does that stick on the president?
He is vulnerable on that, but he's vulnerable among the Republican base, the very traditional hawkish part of the Republican base. But again, as I said before, I don't think that this campaign is going to be about international issues or international affairs. Perhaps it should be, especially what we have going on in Europe, which we haven't had a chance to talk about, right? The economic crisis in Europe. It's going to be about our economy and about jobs. And so I think that that's an issue that's out there, but it's not one that's particularly a huge one for Obama.
Of course, President Obama came back and said, ask Osama bin Laden about appeasement. Mm. And of course, he's Nancy in Omaha, Nebraska. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I wanted to express my appall at John Corzine's testimony that he just doesn't understand where that $1.2 billion disappeared to.
Yes.
Gone in the wind. And it's, to me, you know, that with the Bernie Madoff and the mortgage industry financial debacles that we've seen, and we can't get a vote on a consumer protection agency head because they want a panel of people, the Republicans, it seems to me, like the fox in the hen house. It just enforces my perception that the Republicans are, you know, taking care of the rich.
Nancy, let us pick it up. Our time is short. I think we've got it. Major Garrett, what about that? This week, the former Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray put up to be the first director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Now, this was the one that Elizabeth Warren got up on the rails.
Exactly.
She could not be confirmed. They wouldn't do this either, and they said, we won't do anybody until it's restructured. Right. What's going to happen here?
Well, it's a standoff, and Republicans have the vote to perpetually block this. And I wrote about this at National Journal months ago when Elizabeth Warren was still the candidate or the likely candidate. Mm-hmm. And what struck me then and strikes me now is this is a law adjudicated by Congress, signed by the president, and Republicans are essentially saying we will renounce the law. Until you change it on our terms, we will not give you advice and consent on any nominee. It's not just who it is, are you qualified, not qualified? No one can serve in this legally created capacity without Republicans' approval. That strikes me as a very grand overreach. And beyond the common dimensions of a political disagreement about the approach of the executive branch and clashing of powers and checks and balances, this law exists. It's on the books, and basically Republicans procedurally are openly defying the law.
Laura Washington, speaking of overreach, you had Rob Blagojevich reaching for cash, I guess the courts have found, trying to sell Obama's old Senate seat when he went off to run for president. Now, 14 years he's facing. That is a big number. Why so big? Why so heavy?
It's heavy because James Zagel, the federal court judge that oversaw both trials, remember Blagojevich was tried twice, wants to make an example. You know, and voters are cringing in Illinois. This is our fourth governor convicted since the 1970s.
Incredible.
More than 1,000 people have been convicted of public corruption in the state since the 1970s. We are on a roll. We are the kings when it comes to public corruption in Illinois. And so I think Zagel wanted to send a message. This sentence is twice as long as the previous governor's sentence, which George Ryan got 6.5 years. And actually, I think even though people are embarrassed and cringing about corruption in Illinois, I think that a lot of voters, the people I'm talking to are saying it's a bit of overkill. Blagojevich did, as you say, reach for cash. He did try to trade Obama's Senate seat for campaign contributions, but he never benefited from that. He never actually got any cash or got anywhere with that. And a lot of folks think that this is just when you look at the fact that people are sentenced for violent crimes, even murder, for far less time in many cases than Blagojevich is getting.
The judge says it may take this to get the attention of public officials in Illinois. Well, that ought to get their attention. Jack Beatty, a lot more on the plate here. Europe, we'll be watching that all next week. Durban, the huge climate conference, and almost nothing to say about it. With everything that's going on with the climate, Jack. The North Pole, just the ice cap just going away. And can you believe, there's almost nothing to say here, Jack. Almost nothing happening.
Standoff between the U.S. and China that's been going on for 12 years continues.
Drip, drip, drip. Laura Washington with the Chicago Sun-Times, thank you very much for being with us today.
A pleasure.
Major Garrett at National Journal, you're terrific. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure as always.
And Jack, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.